It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the United States has opened its embassy in Havana, Cuba after more than 50 years. We'll speak with a Wisconsinite who has worked for decades to ease tensions between the two countries.
First, Governor Walker concluded his campaign announcement tour in Iowa yesterday after stops throughout the week in Nevada, South Carolina, Georgia, and New Hampshire.
He formally announced his White House bid last week on Monday after signing the state budget on Sunday. With that hurdle behind him, he's now expected to ramp up his campaign efforts headed into the Republican primary debates next month.
WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson followed Walker to Iowa, and he joins us now for an update from the trail. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, are you noticing any changes, if any at all, in Governor Walker's message and delivery now that he's officially announced?
Changes. You know, I think the thing you notice about Governor Walker after you cover him, you know, a few stops in one day is the remarkable lack of changes from one speech to the next. You know, his supporters like to brag that he is on message. I can tell you at some point he's word for word on message. He knows his stump speech pretty well by now. And, you know, what you hear in one part of the state is going to be remarkably similar to what you hear somewhere else in Iowa.
And as someone who's been tracking this and other candidates, do you see that as a positive, someone who's very on message, but maybe to the letter, literally?
Well, I think it's what's gotten him to where he is today. You know, he's prided himself on that in his runs for governor. It's worked well for him. I mean, just to give you an example of what I'm talking about here, he tells this story about shopping at Kohl's. And, you know, it's ostensibly a way for him to talk about how to sort of frame his economic policy, his tax policy. He says it's similar to the way that Kohl's makes money through volume. He calls it the Kohl's curve. I think what it's really a way for him to do, though, is to tell people, look, I'm like you. I'm one of you. I shop at Kohl's. I use coupons. I'm a regular guy. And he tells his story everywhere. I mean, he has probably told it hundreds of times. He's told it so many times that Jimmy Fallon is now making fun of it on late night TV. He did this really well done compilation of Walker's speeches where he mentions the Kohl's speech. Walker knows that. He even references it on the trail. It does not keep him from telling that speech because he thinks it's effective. And really, the crowds that I saw listening to it loved it.
Right. Well, let's get to those crowds. What is the scene like at these campaign stops? What are you seeing?
They're not huge crowds. I mean, they're not like Bernie Sanders was in Madison a few weeks ago, and we had something like 10,000 people that saw him at that crowd. This is not that. These are small stops in Iowa towns. You know, the day that I followed him, he was in Western and in Central Iowa. You know, they might be at kind of a small location. They're usually pretty packed within that small room. You know, for example, at one of these, he was at a Hy-Vee grocery store in kind of a conference room just upstairs from the grocery store. Definitely not big enough for the number of people they had packed in there. It was really warm, and, you know, people were pretty much hanging on his every word. So that's kind of an atmosphere. A lot of people in a small space. The governor speaks for about 20 minutes. He gets done, and it seems like anybody who comes up to ask him to shake hands or take a picture or sign an autograph, he doesn't seem like he turns any of those down.
Well, he also highlighted his Midwestern roots in his comments to some of the people who came to see him. Here's a little bit of that.
When we lived in Plainfield, our town hall had a flag, an American flag, but it didn't have a state flag. And so I thought that was wrong, and so we went and we washed out a mayonnaise jar, and we put a little slit in the top of it, and we walked around town and gathered up enough coins to buy an Iowa state flag. And like only moms can do, our mom took a picture of David, my brother, and I. I'm the guy on your left, and he's the little guy on the right. And we held up that Iowa state flag there that we put on the city hall in Plainfield, Iowa. So kind of fun to think about that. And only my mom would keep a picture like that. She said, you got to take that and show that to people because they'll get a kick out of that. But not just that flag, but I think about, you know, those kind of roots, not just from my parents, my family, but thinking about that growing up till third grade in Plainfield and then growing up across the Mississippi in Delavan, Wisconsin, a small town, south central Wisconsin. And for me, a lot of it's just the kind of roots here in the Midwest. We're plain spoken. We just get things done. We don't make a lot of fuss.
And Sean, how is that Midwestern trope playing out so far and going over?
If you look at his Iowa poll numbers, people like it in Iowa. I mean, he's the clear front runner in Iowa as of right now. There's a new poll released today showing that he's number one. He's pretty much everybody's first choice. He also leads among who's your second choice. It seems to be going over pretty well. And just anecdotally, people that I talked to at the events where the governor spoke liked it. I mean, his message is, you could kind of boil it down to 2 points there. One, I guess three. One, I'm a regular guy. Two, I got stuff done in Wisconsin. And three, I'm from the Midwest. We need to win the Midwest if we're going to win the presidency. And I'm a Midwest governor. Governors do stuff. So that seems to work. Like I said, in the polls and then anecdotally, he plays very well in Iowa, although it should be noted, you have to win more than Iowa, and the last couple Republicans to win Iowa have not gone on to, major successes in their runs for president.
We're talking to WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson about Governor Walker's presidential campaign announcement tour ended yesterday in Iowa. And Sean, some areas for the governor that have been more complicated. His stance on immigration is one. He's been in the press lately for remarks about same-sex marriage and whether or not it's something that someone is born with or not, to paraphrase that. How is he handling some of these more complex policy or beliefs that he has?
Yeah, the same-sex marriage, I mean, that does not come up in his stump speech. This is something that he was asked about. I mean, he's been asked about it pretty frequently recently, but most recently by CNN in an interview on his campaign RV. And they asked him if being gay was a choice. He said he didn't know if being gay was a choice. So that's something that critics really pounced on right away. Said that Congressman Mark Pocan, who is openly gay, says it's basically a view that's straight out of the 70s. As far as immigration goes, the governor's campaign stops are pretty open. I mean, nobody asks you for ID if you want to go cover them or if you just want to go watch them as a member of the public. Kind of anybody can go. And so yesterday in Iowa, there was a family, an undocumented worker, and his two kids showed up and asked the governor point blank, in their words, why he wants to, tear their family apart. Why is he supporting a lawsuit that would overturn President Obama's executive order that would let, many undocumented families who are here currently stay? And, initially the governor ducked off, and I think he was doing another interview. I wasn't there for that stop, but watching a video that was posted by Voces de la Frontera, and immigrants' rights groups, he did come back and talk to them for a few minutes. And this was something that actually conservatives kind of rallied around, said that he took the right stance. He came back and told them, we're a nation of laws. That's why I support this lawsuit. But that's an issue that's going to be tricky for him in the general election, given the stances he's taken here in the primary.
So does that sort of thing represent a shift to you? He got some criticism early on for maybe taking a pass on some tough questions and didn't answer press questions on some of his foreign tours. Is that changing? Is he answering pretty much everything that comes his way these days?
I don't know if he's answering. I mean, there are still issues where, for example, he was at this family leadership summit, which is a group, it's an event organized by a conservative Christian group, and he was asked questions from the audience, everything from why aren't we throwing activist judges in jail to, can we ban lobbyists? And I mean, the governor doesn't exactly come out and give a yes or no answer to can we make lobbyists illegal or throw judges in jail. He kind of steers it toward one of the talking points that's in his stump speech anyway. So I don't know if you're getting absolute 100% direct answers from the governor on this stuff, but he is answering more when it comes to these issues. I think one thing for me, having covered him in state races, now seeing him run a race for president, and he never talked about foreign policy before, and now he talks about it quite a bit, and it's really, I mean, it's really an aggressive foreign policy, at least in the tone of his remarks. He sounds like someone who would be a president who would not mind getting involved in, you know, foreign conflicts and in wars. He says that that tough talk is there to promote peace, although there are, you know, certainly, you know, even members of the service who worry that that would lead us into more wars.
Sean, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was WPR State Capitol reporter Sean Johnson talking about Governor Walker's presidential campaign announcement tour, which ended yesterday in Iowa. The Cuban flag is flying in Washington, D.C. today for the first time in 54 years. It marks the reestablishment of diplomatic ties between the two countries and the reopening of embassies in both Havana and D.C.
Supporters of warmer relations say the move is long overdue and that the United States' approach to Cuba is a remnant of Cold War policies. Those who oppose the move criticize Cuba's record on human rights and say they'd like to see more political reform in that country first.
Some critics, like Florida Senator Marco Rubio, have Cuban backgrounds themselves. But one Wisconsin member of the Cuban exile community sees reason to celebrate. Ricardo Gonzalez moved to Miami from Cuba when he was 13 and has been advocating for closer relations for 40 years.
He's a former alderman of the city of Madison and the founder of the Madison Camagüey Sister City Program. Ricardo, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
So first, your personal feelings today. You've been following this for a long time. This is personal to you, given your history. What do you think, seeing these embassies reopening today?
I think it's a very good step. In fact, it's a very needed step if we want to move forward toward normalization. This is not the end of the issue. In fact, this is only the beginning now that we have embassies in each other's countries and that we can sit down and begin to discuss and try to solve the many issues that separate both countries.
And this has been coming for a while. December was kind of a big turning point with the first announcements. Did that come out of nowhere for you?
That kind of got me by surprise. I thought I knew what was happening a little bit, you know, but the announcement on the 17th of December, I think, took everyone by surprise. And it was a victory both for U.S. diplomacy and for Cuban diplomacy.
So why did you start getting involved in advocating for this warming of relations decades ago?
Well, when I was a college student, I took a special interest in studying U.S.-Cuba relations. And it was obvious to me after reading up several books that the issue between Cuba and the United States went back a lot longer than just the revolution of 1959, that what we were dealing with really was the end result of a policy of interference on the part of the United States going back to the early part of the 19th century when the United States set its eyes on Cuba and decided that Cuba must be ours and that Cuba had to be part of the American Republic of the American nation without any regard really to what the Cubans thought about that. And I think the stage was set certainly after our intervention in Cuba in 1898 to for the Cuban Revolution that came in 1959. So what we have to learn now is from that history. It's very important that we do not repeat the same mistakes, that we recognize that this time around, we're dealing with a sovereign Cuba, that the battle of this revolution over 54 years has been for Cuban sovereignty. And if we want real, honest, and stable relations with the nation of Cuba, we must recognize that Cuba is a sovereign nation, and it will do what it will do.
Can you tell us the story of your move to the United States from Cuba?
Well, that was back in 1960. At that time, the rumor going around in the island was that children under 16 were going to be taken away from their parents and sent to Russia for indoctrination. So obviously, my parents, along with many others, were alarmed by this and decided to send their kids out of Cuba. even though I was not part of that Peter Pan project, the efforts that followed were came to be known as the Peter Pan project, which in which many Cuban parents sent their kids to the United States unaccompanied, unaccompanied, and those kids, 14,000 of them, many of them never saw their parents again. This happened between 1960 and 1962. Luckily, I was able to come with my father, and he then left us, me and my brother, in the home of an uncle there in Miami, and then he returned to Cuba. So I missed that process that the Peter Pan kids went through.
And your brother, I understand, was involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion.
My oldest brother, yes, he fought at the Bay of Pigs. He was one of the members of the Brigade 2506, and he spent 20 months in jail there in Havana afterwards until 1962, when President John F. Kennedy arranged for the release of the prisoners in an exchange for food and medicine.
Talking to Ricardo Gonzalez, founder of the Madison Camagüey Cuba Sister City Program, about thawing relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Coming back to the present day, Ricardo, we mentioned a lot of people in the U.S., a lot of Cuban Americans still, including those in politics, say we're doing this backwards. We shouldn't be thawing relations until Cuba opens up its government, reforms its government, changes some human rights policies. Do you think there's something to that? Do you think things need to change within Cuba as well as between Cuba and the United States?
Well, but those political issues inside Cuba are a matter for the Cubans to resolve. We cannot impose preconditions like that on Cuba because they don't make any sense. That has been the problem all along. We don't impose those conditions on Saudi Arabia, for instance, or Egypt, or China, or Vietnam, and we have relations with those countries. So the question here is that what are we going to do to move forward? We have had a policy of embargo and isolation on Cuba for 54 years, and it has failed terribly. The majority of Americans want this change. The overwhelming majority of the Cuban people support this new policy. It is time for a change, and President Obama is on the right track, and this is long overdue.
And you mentioned this being a starting point and the trade embargo. Do you think we're going to see a change in that embargo anytime soon?
Well, I certainly hope so. There are several pieces of legislation now making the rounds in the Congress, and we hope that these will be taken up soon and that they will be voted in the affirmative. But as you know, the Congress is now in the under the control of the Republican Party, and the Republicans are somewhat wedded to the views of what they consider to be the dominant view of Cuban Americans in Miami, which is no longer true. Even the majority of Cubans in the Miami area support an end to the embargo, support open travel and family relationships in Cuba.
You've been working with this Sister City Project here in Wisconsin, there in Cuba. What changes now in this thing you've been working on for so long?
Well, it enables us to visit there more regularly without so many regulations. Although, to be sure, the embargo prohibits tourist travel to Cuba. So in order to go to Cuba, you have to have an organized program. You have to go through a certain process, and it's not that easy, and it's expensive as well. So if you want to visit Cuba, you have to go with some organization that has a plan, educational program, a humanitarian program, an academic program, something along those lines. So what this will mean now is that it'll just make it easier to go, but not quite open yet.
There's been thought that opening up trade contacts, more visiting to Cuba, might make some of the positive changes that the embargo was aimed to do, reforming government, opening things up. There's also concern that a flood of investment or tourism from the U.S. could overwhelm the unique things about Cuban culture. What are your worries and hopes there?
Well, that is true, especially in the city of Havana, which is by default, in a way, has maintained its look and its attitudes from the 50s in many ways. You know, those old cars, the old buildings, they have survived the last 50 years where every other big city in the world has seen tremendous changes, tremendous development. But I think all of that will be taken in stride. And things are not going to change that fast. It'll take a while, and we need to get used to that. This is not going to happen overnight, but change is definitely in the way.
Ricardo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Ricardo Gonzalez, founder of the Madison Camagüey Sister City Program, former alderman of the city of Madison. He moved to the U.S. from Cuba when he was 13. We've been talking about the reestablishment of diplomatic ties between the two countries today after more than 50 years. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Is there something or someone in your life that you can point to and say, that single thing really shaped me as a person? That experience inspired the worldview or the passion that I've carried throughout my life? When you hear successful people talk about their lives, they often point to a formative thing that led them to do whatever it is that they accomplished, kind of like Steve Jobs and a calligraphy class that he sat in on at Reed College.
For our next guest, that thing is pretty common, something almost anyone could experience. It's a board game. It's chess. Eugene Brown was incarcerated in federal prison after a botched bank robbery. While behind bars, he learned to play the game of chess. In the process, he began to apply a lesson of that game to his own life. Think before you move. His story was turned into the movie Life of a King, starring Cuba Gooding Jr.
Anybody know how to play chess?
And everyone on the board is here for one reason and one reason only. To protect the king. In here and in life, you must think before you move.
Eugene went on to become a real estate agent and investor and now teaches at-risk kids how to play chess through his organization, the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. He's in Wausau today and tomorrow speaking with high school students, and he'll talk at a public event at 6:30 p.m. tomorrow at the Center for Health Sciences at North Central Technical College. And he joins us now. Eugene, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm here.
Well, how were you first introduced to chess?
Well, chess came to me in Washington, D.C. one summer back probably in the early 60s, community-based program, Afrocentric-oriented, and one of the guys, Baba Mishore, he introduced chess to all of us. We just learned how to push the pieces, how to set the board up, and it really didn't have a real impact on me until years later.
And yet, Eugene, tell us how you rediscovered chess in prison.
Well, initially in 69, I was arrested in Paterson, New Jersey. Paterson, New Jersey in Passaic County is probably it is the same county that Harry Rubicane Carter came out of. And I was sent to Trenton State Prison. At the time, I was a fugitive from justice for a bank robbery charge, so that meant I had two cases pending, and I ended up getting sentenced in the state of New Jersey, and I was sent back to Washington, D.C. for extradition, and I got a 12-year sentence there. And so when I got back to Trenton State Prison, I was lucky because I'm a barber by trade. I learned barbering. That was my high school trade. And I was sort of like an elite prisoner in the state of New Jersey. My job used to be, I used to cut everyone's hair that used to come in. I met a lot of influential people, underworld people. But it gave me some liberties that other prisons didn't have. So that meant that I could go out to the yard twice. But chess as repeated bouts of being incarcerated as a youth, that was always one of the games that I gravitated towards because of I was an introvert. I never kind of lumped up with, you know, the gangs or anything like that. So as my chess experience grew, I kind of started following chess with the chesslers that they call themselves in Trenton. And that's where I kind of really got involved in the game. But the game really struck me. One day I was on an errand taking some books up to another wing, and I saw a brother in there with three boards set up in his cell. And you would have thought that he was a nuclear scientist. He had a book in one hand and three boards set up. And I was looking in his cell, and he kind of felt me, which probably was a violation, and it was. And he turned around. He said, "Can I help you?" So I said, I'm just wondering, why do you have three boards set up? Because in my mind, it was like maybe he had did too much time, you know, and I was kind of intrigued. So he said, well, he said, the three boards are set up because I'm doing different variations of, and I'm opening and I'm expanding my opening repertoire. He said, do you play? I said, yes. He says, what opening do you use? I said, I just play. And he kind of laughed, like, you know. So he said, well, and he took me through a whole one-on-one chess experience that I never forgot. He explained it, the theology of chess. He explained, you know, why, what the advantage of white moving. A lot of people think it's racist, he said, but, you know, like, it's an offense and a defense. What, if you're playing the black side, you have to just struggle for the initiative. You know what the initiative is, don't you? So I said, well, not quite. And then he showed me, and this guy was just so, you know, the bars and the experience, he had transcended that whole prison experience into a whole learning experience. So he said, well, you know, after the end, he said, well, I'll see you on the yard, and if I get a chance, I'll go over some games with you. And but his thing was, that's how he kind of made his living. He gambled on the yard, and he saw me playing a game once, and he came over and kind of critiqued it. And he said, you know, you could have had him, he said, but, you know, you kind of went about it a long way, and you didn't want to lose a piece. But he kept giving me these type of insights into the game. And then he said, if you meet me in a chow hall later on, I'll give you a book on beginners.
We're talking right now with Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. He's in Wausau today and tomorrow, talking with children, at-risk kids, about how to use chess as sort of a roadmap for life. And I'm curious, listening to you talk, Eugene, what is it about chess in particular? What is it about this game that you think gives this kind of discipline and mental sharpness that maybe another game wouldn't give?
Well, one of the things I know from experience is the fact that it teaches you how to concentrate. And once you learn how to concentrate, I think that there's a whole lot of other doors that open to you because, you know, the brain is just like any muscle, and the more you use it, the stronger it gets. And if you could sit down for 2 hours and play a game of chess, if you could sit down for an hour, 2 hours, you can take that same concentration package into any endeavor. So that's learning different techniques and strategies and having a plan. You know, I think somewhere they say life is but a dream, but chess has taught me that life is but a plan.
And your slogan in your efforts to teach kids has been think before you move. And it seems like chess is a really good way to learn that lesson. How are you seeing the kids you work with taking that lesson and living with it?
Well, through different modules that we try to employ into the think before you move, one of the things that's early learned in chess is that if you touch a piece, you have to move a piece. And that teaches you that even before you move that piece, you have to know where you're going. And it started giving you a visualization as to how this board is going to look maybe 3 or 4 moves down the line. And on my way in, I was getting a piece of candy out of a jar. And the first thing I told the announcer here was that I said, you know, this is where chess starts. He said, well, what do you mean? So as I went into the jar, I looked back over one shoulder, and I looked back over the other shoulder, like a kid going in a cookie jar. I said, that's one of the first experiences I know in playing chess.
And how did it end up changing your life once you had locked down some of those lessons of discipline and thinking before you moved?
Well, I think the greatest concept that I've learned that really turned the corner in my life was the fact that I had always blamed people for the position that I was in. And the guy that taught me, his name was Massey. We call him the chess man. What he taught me was a life-changing experience. He taught me that he almost grabbed, put his arm around me and looked right at me, held the king in his hand. He said, you know, you're the king. You're the one that's responsible for every move that's made on your side of the board. You can't blame anyone for anything that happens on your side of the board. All of these pieces look for you to give them a job. And until you accept your kingship, you're always going to be a follower.
We're talking to Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. His story of using chess to turn his life around after years in prison inspired the movie Life of a King. He's in Wausau today and tomorrow.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any questions for Eugene Brown? Do you play chess? Is it something that resonates with you about the life lessons that chess can teach you? Or maybe something else in your life that served as an inspiration like chess did for Eugene Brown? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now with Eugene Brown. He's the founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C. His story of using chess to turn his life around after years in prison inspired the movie Life of a King. And he's in Wausau today and tomorrow.
He'll be talking about his story and about his efforts to teach kids how to play chess, to teach them to think before they move in the game and in life. And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for Eugene Brown? Is there something in your life, maybe chess, maybe a hobby, maybe a mentor that served as an inspiration like chess did for him? Have you taught chess to kids? What do you see them getting out of it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Eugene, let's talk about teaching chess to kids who've maybe never played the game before. It's a tough game, can be an unforgiving game. What are the kids' first reactions when you're teaching them chess?
Well, you know, in chess and in life, there's three stages. There's the opening, there's the middle, and the end. When I teach chess, I always teach the opening game and how important it is to develop your pieces. And in life, your opening game is how important it is to develop your skills. So the way that I always go about setting up the chessboard is a very unique way that I explain it. The king lives in a castle, and I identify the castle. Who works in front of the castle? The pawns. Who rides around the castles all day? The horses. Who rides on the horses? The knights. Who's the closest to the king and queen? The bishops. Why are the bishops the closest to the queen, king and queen? Because the bishops give the king and queen spiritual advice. Who's the only thing that's left? And with that, they learn how to set the board up and learn the pieces. So the game from there, we just implement piece after piece. We learn how the pawn moves, how the rooks, the castle moves, how the knights move. And they don't learn chess until later on. They learn how to take pieces at an early stage, and then they learn how to play chess later. And so the first concept is learning the opening game. How is the opening game related to your life? And, you know, if they just walk away from our club learning how to play chess and saying, I beat him, he beat me, we've missed our whole mission. Our whole mission is to be able to take this game off the board and to apply it into your everyday life. So chess have also taught me how to negotiate, because most of the moves on the board is a negotiation, you know. And how do you win in negotiating? You have to give something to give a little back. You have to give this, you know, and a lot of times it's a sacrifice. And sacrifices don't always mean that you're losing. Sacrifice actually is a gain. So they're learning a life skill as they learn chess from the way that is taught from the Big Chair Chess Club.
Can you tell us about one or two of the kids that you've worked with and how chess maybe changed the course that they were on and the way they thought about the world?
Sure. You're talking about kids that in Washington, D.C. that came out of public housing, that were surrounded with elements that was conducive for failure. And for them to come out of that environment, and I came out of almost the same type of environment, so the commonality of experience, you know, have been a big help to me to be able to identify that it's just a matter of being able to change the paradigm, being able to change that self-image. And a lot of that self-image is changed on the chessboard when they see that they can achieve something that they thought they never could do. Playing chess was maybe like for a nerd and for them to sit there and beat a guy that they thought was smarter than them simply because they knew how to play the game. And knowing how to play the game is so important because anything that you do, you have to learn how to play the game. So it's like life. You know, chess. I teach chess is the only game that can't be won. It can only be played. Life is the only game that you can't win life. You just play it. What is it? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So you're never winning in life.
Is there pushback from kids at first? Like you said, they might think of this as the smart kid's game or the nerd's game. Is it tough sometimes to just get them to sit at the table in the first place?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of them, I've even heard them say, well, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for that. And my pat answer has been, you got time to make a mistake. And so some of those things that end up catching their ear is the fact that, you know, you learn it on the board or you can learn it in the street. And most of what you learn in the street is miseducation. I tell a kid today, and I just left a group of kids, and I saw them when I asked them about some of their occupations that they wish they had or some of the things that they could do looking at their end game. And they asked me, well, what do you wish you had? I said, I wish I had been a drug seller. They said, I don't believe that. I said, yeah. I said, I could have been a pharmacist and sold drugs all my life. That's what pharmacists do. But they never heard it from that vernacular and looking at it from a different angle. And it's the same on the chessboard. You think you being in a tough position, and you may be in a winning position. And it's just a matter of how you look at things, how you look at yourself. Your self-concept determines. So learning this game or learning any other game, you're going to have to use the same principles because principles don't change. And you're going to find out that if you don't know how to play the game, someone else will be playing you. So that's always good ear because this is almost the language that they hear on a regular basis. This is the language of the streets. You know, this is their lingo. So I've been able to connect because I know a lot of it, and I know if it was able to turn me around, I know the power of the game. You know, and being able to articulate my experiences because I think that's what a teacher has the ability to do, to facilitate conscious thought and be able to entertain people with the spoken word. So I know I've been gifted to be able to translate you making mistakes out of impulsive moves. I have a program right now in Raleigh, North Carolina, on death row. And the death row chess players have been able to say them. They've actually woke me up to the strength of this game. They say anytime I can sit 3-4 hours in a chess game and forget all that's going on around me, this is a powerful game.
Yeah, that is something about chess. It can be incredibly time-consuming. It's you and somebody else sometimes just staring at a board in silence for a really long time. Do you ever think of it as a kind of meditation?
Yes. You said a key word, and you know, one of the techniques I use, if I'm in a classroom, 10 minutes before we start is complete silence. And the complete silence is if anyone breaks the silence, they have to step out the room because we identify that person as the weakest link. And we'll sit there, no one makes a sound, and I use that technique to quiet the mind down, and that is meditation. 10 minutes just before the closing of the session, the board's up, and we go back through the silence. So I've been able to use that because I know once the mind has been quiet, this is a teaching moment.
Talking to Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Washington, D.C., in Wausau, to talk about the value of chess. So teaching kids, you've done that, Eugene. You've taken this to death row. What's next? How do you want to expand your love of the game and bring it to more people?
Well, I was in an ABC Up Close interview. Actually, this is where the movie was spawned from, ABC Up Close in 2002. And at the end of the interview, they asked me about my end game. They said, well, what's your end game? I said, I have a chess club like this in every major city across country. And I didn't even realize I had said that. And a lady in Bakersfield, California, that had a chess program, she's kind of taking me up on that. So now I have a big chair chess club in Bakersfield, California. Matter of fact, 10 of those kids came to Washington, D.C. November the 22nd, and we were invited to the Cosmos Club there, which is a very ritzy club on Embassy Row. And that was quite an experience. And I think alternative education, I think this is an ideal, because I was teaching chess in Catawba County at an alternative school. And for some kids, I stayed there 2 years, and kids that were very disruptive, behavior problems, we were able to send five of those kids back to their regular high school, and they graduated with honor. And those kids, three of them now went to the military, and two of them are in college right now.
That's a great place to leave it. That was Eugene Brown, founder of the Big Chair Chess Club in Wausau. Now he's speaking at a public event at 6:30 tomorrow in Wausau at North Central Technical College. We talked about fish fry on Food Friday last week, and since that conversation, we've been getting more of your suggestions for great fish fry around the state.
On Facebook, Mary writes, "My favorite fish fry is the Capri Steakhouse in Columbus, Wisconsin. All the usual fare, plus twice-baked potatoes and deep-fried bullheads," which we looked up, Rob and I.
It's a fish. No surprise in context,
sense,
but we didn't
right?
know for sure.
And she goes on to say, "In the magic of Matthew Teague, performed at the bar or your table while you wait."
I've been to the Capri in Columbus. I haven't had the fish fry. I've just been there for lunches midweek, and I haven't seen the magic show. We also heard from Gordy, who's been helping serve up fish fry. He writes, "I'm a Knights of Columbus member. I've been involved in our fish fries for 20 years at the Southern Eau Claire County Parish of St. Raymond's. During Lent, we serve baked and deep fried cod along with French fries, au gratin potatoes," that's a nice side, "green beans, baked beans, fresh homemade coleslaw, tartar sauce, butter and rolls, and dessert." He says, fantastic.
And Karen writes, "Jackson Madison has a great gluten-free fish fry for those who have celiac or gluten allergy. You can also get fries or potato pancakes."
We were lamenting the loss of the Orpheum fish fry in Madison with bluegill.
Bluegill,
which is awesome. One of our callers on Friday talked
about
bluegill.
We're both really into the notion of
potato pancakes. Yeah, that's what I'm really hungry for after all this fish fry talk. So send your potato pancakes to... Oh, no, wait. Those won't hold up well in the mail.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.